All right, well, it's my great pleasure to introduce Toby Stafford from University of Michigan, who will tell us about non-commutative projective geometry.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me back. It's been a while since I've been down here. I think it was just before you came here, John. Mike was down here, and I came down for a week or so. So it's a long time ago, anyway. So what I want to talk about is non-commutative projective geometry, and the question you can always ask in this situation is, what do you mean by non-commutative geometry? Since it's any combination of people who do something geometric and something non-commutative, at least if it's the union of the two, it's everybody. If it's the intersection of the two, it's almost nobody. So any two people who do this sort of subject will have a different definition. So my definition for this talk is, really, it's the use or interaction of geometry, algebraic geometry, with non-commutative algebra, and trying to interact the two. And even there, there are many versions. The older one would have been what you might call non-commutative affine geometry, where you try to use the ideas of affine geometry, looking at speck of a ring, and trying to do that in a non-commutative universe. That never worked very well. And I think the reason was that affine geometry, the way you tend to do this work locally, you localize your ring at a maximal ideal and use Nakayama's lemma or something. That doesn't work in the non-commutative case for the simple reason you can't localize. So there's a second problem, what you mean by a non-commutative geometry. We'll come to that in a moment. So what I want to talk about is non-commutative projective geometry. And this really does seem to have quite a lot of powerful applications. And I think really the reason is that there are global techniques that you can use in projective geometry, and those somehow go across rather easily. And so it's this application of the global techniques of projective geometry that I want to talk about here. And I hope I haven't scared off too many people in the audience by the use of the words here, non-commutative geometry. I'm going to really try and keep this very elementary. And so if you're not familiar with geometry, and certainly if you're not familiar with global techniques, cohomology and such like, don't worry, because the cases of these words that I really need are going to be very elementary. And I will try keeping things down to the minimum so that really you don't have to, you will understand where I'm heading, at least in sort of interesting initial examples where it's still non-trivial. So given I'm dealing with projective geometry, so the archetype here should be that the P1 is the basic variety I'm going to look at, and I should think of that as take polynomial rings in two variables and take all the graded homogeneous ideals. So if the polynomial ring is in X and Y, I take all ideals that are generated by a single element of the form lambda times X mu times Y. So that's going to be P1. And given I'm doing projective geometry in that sense, I should always be talking about graded rings. I'm talking about the polynomial ring there, thought of as a graded ring. So I'm always going to be working in the situation where we can see the top of the slide. I'm working always over a fixed algebraically closed field for simplicity, and I'm always working with graded algebras. This will be connected graded in the sense that it's an n-graded ring, so Ri times Rj is inside Ri plus j, but R0 should be the base field. And then it should be reasonably finite, so it should be a finitely generated algebra. The individual pieces should be finite dimensional over the base field. But the one crucial extra condition I'm making for this talk is that the ring is generated in degree 1. And if I have time later, I'll talk about when that doesn't happen. So I'm always going to assume I've got a ring generated by R1. And in fact, it's also going to be in the theorem in all the examples I talk about, which by its will also force the pieces to be finite dimensional. So then when I'm talking about graded rings, I should be talking about graded modules. So the modules will always be, again, in this case, z-graded modules. M is the direct sum of mi. And probably small grade r should really be Noetherian modules. But my rings are going to be Noetherian, so Noetherian module, finitely generated module, they're the same thing. And I should apologize about these slides. These are Michigan slides. So one of the conditions of Michigan slides is that you've got to keep them on ice. So when I brought them down here, things started melting. So you'll see that various bits of these slides, despite the fact I only made them yesterday, they're already disintegrating. But again, in commutative geometry, projective geometry, you ignore the augmentation ideal of your polynomial ring in two variables, the irrelevant ideal. So you ignore modules which are finite length over the base field. So to do that, I should look not at the category of graded modules, but the quotient category, grade R mod the finite dimensionals. So this is a nice, easy object to look at. I mean, there are many ways of thinking about this. First of all, the objects, they're just modules, same as graded modules. But by factoring out finite dimensional modules, what I mean is if I give you two modules, say a module and a submodule, which differ by a finite dimensional module, then I'm going to regard them as the same. So maps are isomorphisms if the kernel or co-kernel are just finite dimensional vector spaces. So my intuition is always going to be that Q grade R is the space I'm going to think about. Now, if I'm doing non-commutative geometry, you always say you're going to be working in coherent sheaves on proj R. This actually has no meaning because proj R is a meaningless space. It doesn't exist. But the intuition of working with coherent sheaves on this non-existent space is what's going to be pervasive through the lecture, and it really is something that works very well. It's a very useful, efficient tool for giving you the right intuition and also the right way of using geometry. So to think about what I mean by that and what I mean by these words, let me start off by thinking about purely the commutative case. So there I'm talking about a projective variety, and basically we can think about P1. And on that I'm going to take an invertible sheaf and look at L, and I'm going to look at the space of coherent sheaves. So let me immediately give you what the standard example of what these words mean. So this is going to be, as I said, I'm going to take P1, and you think of the bottom line, as I said before, I'm thinking of P1 as proj of a polynomial ring in two variables, so all the homogeneous ideals. And what I want to do with that is I want to go backwards. So the interplay, commutative algebra, and certainly in this talk, is going back between algebra and geometry. So in the commutative case, graded rings, you go from polynomial ring in two variables to proj of that, P1. But I want to go back as well, because I want to use geometry to give myself interesting structures in non-commutative algebra, and dealing with non-commutative algebras in a geometric way. And the way I do that is through this thing, which I call the homogeneous coordinate ring, base field K plus the direct sum of global sections of tensor powers of L. And so I thought I ought to explain what I mean by that with an explicit example. So my example is P1. So I think of that the other way. Rational functions would be rational functions in an indeterminate U. So inside P1, I have my two copies of the affine line. I can either delete the point at infinity, in which case I'm just thinking of the coordinate ring as polynomials in U. Or I could delete the origin, in which case the defined function, global defined functions there, polynomials in U inverse. My invertible sheaf, well, that's just some sheaf sitting inside rational functions generated by some elements. So I'm going to generate by 1 and U. That'll give me O1. So that just means that on the polynomial ring in U, I take the module generated by 1 and U. In other words, I get polynomials in U. And on polynomials in U inverse, again, I'm taking the module generated by 1 and U. So, but that's now U times KU inverse. So in the global sections, you just take the intersection of these two things. So in this case, you see the intersection U and 1 are in both of these modules. So the global sections, two-dimensional vector space generated by 1 and U, which I'm going to call X and Y. I want to give them names. So then I tensor up. So tensor up just on both of the open affine pieces. So on KU, I'm just tensoring KU with itself, I get KU. On the other side, tensoring U times KU inverse by itself, I'm going to get U squared. So now I'm getting three global sections, 1, U, and U squared, but I ought to give them labels which indicate they're in degree 2, so I think of this as X squared, XY, and Y squared. Of course, you can see where I'm going at this point. I've got polynomials of degree 2, 1, 2, take the nth tensor power, you'll get polynomials, homogeneous polynomials of degree n. Putting them all together, what's my multiplication in this ring? Well, you can sort of guess I'm tensoring is the same as I'm using tensor product as multiplication. So the polynomial ring in two variables is the ring I get up out of this. So there we are. There's the first course in algebraic geometry. Actually, the first two courses. I talked about local cohomology as well, H0. So if I'm to do this, I also should say that I get something out of it. I could always construct anything out of anything else, but it would be meaningless unless there's some real point to the correspondence. And that's Sayre's theorem, which says in these situations, that if I do this going back and forth, then the categories of modules I'm talking about are the same. So on the commutative geometric side, so I'm looking at coherent sheaves, so those are just modules. And then I form this twisted homogeneous coordinate, this homogeneous coordinate ring I've been talking about. And at least if the L is big enough, formally it should be ample. So on Pn, P1, O1 is ample, On is ample. Ample is not a severe condition. Then the ring I get out of this twisted homogeneous coordinate ring, first of all, it's finitely generated in the theory in K-algebra, just like the polynomial ring in two variables. And the categories are the same. Q grade of B is the same as coherent sheaves on X. And I can go back and forth. Starting with B, I can go to X and back to B. Starting with B, I can get to X and then back to B. So that's the commutative theory. Non-commutative theory. So the simplest way of getting non-commutative algebras out of commutative algebras is to take an automorphism and twist things. So there are going to be two strains to this talk, which of course, in some sense, are the same as the commutative one. I want to go from geometry to algebra, and then algebra back to geometry. So the first step is going from the geometry to create non-commutative algebras out of it. And so this I'm going to do by twisting things with an automorphism. So once again, let me do two slides simultaneously. So the words are what I'm going to construct are up there. And what I'm going to do is take the same example I had before, but put this sigma into the game. So again, it's P1, O1, it's the same sheaf generated by 1 and U, or X and Y, as I've been calling them. And what are the two things I want to do to them? So what I claim I get out of this, I'm going to take the simplest automorphism I can think of. On P1, I just multiply one of the entries by Q. And in the non-commutative universe, those of you who have ever seen this subject called quantum groups, you always start with the quantum affine plane. So this is polynomials in X and Y with the relations X, Y equals Q, Y equals. The whole game starts with that, and you can ask yourself why. Well, one answer to that question comes in this lecture. So given that the simplest automorphism is multiplying by Q, and quantum algebras are called, you call these Q quantum algebras, or Q algebras, or quantum algebras, the obvious, you've got to get that algebra. So the theorem is you've got to get it, so let's just prove that. So let's convert everything to algebra. So the automorphism, thinking about it as automorphisms of P1, that's the same as thinking about it as automorphisms of rational functions, and then it's just multiplication by Q. So let's think about what that does. So on O1, well, I've got 1 and U. They're sent to 1 and Q times U. So the L sigma doesn't change. I've just multiplied the generators by a scalar. So L doesn't change. Ln, that was this tensor power. Instead of taking L tensor L, I'm going to take L and then take the tensor, twist it by sigma, tensor of that, twist by sigma squared, tensor of that, and so on. So it hasn't changed. Nothing's changed. So, of course, when I take these global sections, nothing changes. I get the polynomial ring in X and Y. So I've done nothing, we can go home. Except if I think about these objects, I have to walk over here. My wife hates it when I walk across the stage in a lecture, but I've been, fortunately things have been set up, so I'm forced to do so. So think about how I'm going to multiply these together. So in the commutative case, tensor product was multiplication. But to take the tensor product of two of these things, I've got to get the next one. So, for example, to go from degree 1 to degree 2, I'm going to take L and then tensor with L, but that second one's got to be twisted by sigma. So, by multiplication, I've got to take the Ln and the Lm and then twist the second one by the appropriate power of sigma, sigma to the n, so that then when I take the tensor product of these two, I get all my twists, L, L sigma, up to L to the sigma to the n plus n minus 1. So that's what I do. The map is the only thing you can do, and in the middle, you twist by sigma, and then again, you just take the tensor product and take whatever sections you get out of that, whatever are the global sections, and that is then the Bn plus n. So if I go back here and I see what I'm trying to do in that situation, the modification, you see, here I think purely in terms of functions, x and y, so I take x tensor y, or 1 tensor u, and then I twist it by the second one by sigma. So x was 1, y was u, so that becomes qu, so I get qu. But when I do it the other way around, y times x, now you see it's the x that's getting hit by sigma. 1 to the sigma is 1. Sigma never does anything to the identity, so I get u. So you see the x times y is q times yx. Xy is qyx. So to recap, what I've got here is I've just got a polynomial ring in x and y, except my modification is defined by x times y equals y times x, so I have to have this ring. So there's my starting point. And as I said, in this situation, there's no point in doing this unless you had this variant of Serre's theorem, which said that, well, let's just put it up again. You had L was ample, then this homogeneous coordinate ring was finitely generated in the theory in K-algebra, and Q grade of B was the same as the theory in Sheaves. Well, I want to bring the sigma into the game. If I'm going to bring it into there, I better bring it everywhere else. So that better be this L sub n. And then, of course, I'm going to change the word. I'm going to call it sigma. And Serre's not allowed to have this theorem. He has quite enough. So this is due to Artin and Vandenberg. Well, I sort of feel it should be Artin and Vandenberg and Tate, because it sort of appears in the joint paper of the three of you, although this, at this level it was really only in the paper of the two of them. So that's the theorem. And the remark that goes with it, fortunately we can't get the whole slide on, is at the bottom, is this sigma ample business. So the definition was the same as before. You take a sheaf, tensor width an Ln, and this should be big enough so that the thing you're ending up with actually is generated by global sections. So I mean, in case of P1, if I took O minus 1, generated by 1 and U inverse, then there have been no take the intersection of those two modules, you have no intersection, so you have no global sections. So here I just say that it's sort of L is big enough that I tensor some module F, sheaf F, with a high tensor power of L, that at least it's generated by sections as O1 is. And the comment is that for all the cases in this talk, irreducible curves, Pn, things like that, actually doesn't matter. Sigma ample and ample are the same. But in general, it's actually a rather strange, subtle condition. Not all varieties, not all projective schemes have sigma ample line bundles. For example, even when you get up to surfaces, so-called K3 surfaces, can have no sigma ample line bundles at all. In that situation, there's no way of doing this transference of going from commutative to non-commutative. And in fact, what happens in those situations where you don't have any of these sigma ample line bundles is that the algebra, the L in some sense is too big. So that the algebras you get out of this, they're no longer finitely generated. The finitely generated should grow like a polynomial ring. The number of terms you have in each degree should be, the dimensions should be bounded by a polynomial. But these things will grow exponentially, so it looks much more like a free algebra. I guess what's happening is, without the sigma ample condition, the L and the L sigma just get pushed too far apart. So instead of, like this case, you know, you've got 1 xy yx, or x xy yx y squared, so you get things that are the same. You just get blown completely apart, so there's no coincidences. So things just get completely haywire. But anyway, the theory in general is understood. It's work of Keeler. And so you can determine exactly when algebras have these sigma ample line bundles. But in the cases we're talking about, everything has one, so it's not a problem. OK. So that gives us the situation we're in. We're talking about trying to mimic the commutative theory. And we have this way of going between algebra and geometry. Or at least we have a way of going from geometry to algebra, by we take our favorite variety, automorphism, and we can form this twisted homogeneous coordinate. So here I just get Q. So now I can ask myself, well, does it do me any good? So let's start thinking about applications. So in the commutative case, if you look at the usual book for commutative algebra, Hartshorne, in some sense you
do some general theory. We've done that. And then you have a chapter on curves, a chapter on surfaces, and then you're done. So let's start with curves. So what do I mean by a non-commutative curve first? So this is algebra rather than the geometry. So it should be thinking that I should be taking Q grade of algebras. So in the commutative case P1, that's for algebra polynomial ring in two variables. That's any surface, any curve looks like that. I should be looking at a ring where the homogeneous pieces grow linearly. Polynomial ring in two variables, there's only n plus one elements in degree n. So let's take a ring that looks like that. It should be in domain, connected graded, as I said, and the individual pieces, the dimensions grow linearly. And then we're done. So the ring's over there. So the theorem is that in that situation, you really do have one of these twisted homogeneous coordinate rings. You take a curve, you take an automorphism, you take an invertible sheaf, and then you take this B of XL sigma. Such statements, by the way, even in the commutative case, they're only ever true up to finite dimensions. You can't distinguish finite dimensional differences because we're working with Q grade. So that's the theorem. And once I've got that, I can apply the Artin Vandenberg theorem and say, right, well, Q grade of B is the same as coherent sheaves on X. If you don't like geometry, well, that's the same as Q grade of the commutative ring, X, L, and 1. So given that the non-commutative curve is coherent sheaves on R rather than R itself, what this proves is that non-commutative curves are commutative. And even at the level of this example, I think that's really rather surprising. So let's take Q to be at least not a root of unity. And think about what the algebra I have here. So if you thought about this in the original way of doing algebraic geometry, I take the ring and I take all the homogeneous prime ideals, and that's my proj. It's a perfectly valid definition. It doesn't get you anywhere in this case, because this ring has only two proper ideals, x and y. You took the ideal generated, for example, tried to take x plus y and take the two-sided ideal that generates, you find you get everything up to finite dimensions. So this ring only has these two ideals, so it looks nothing like the commutative case. Yet I'm saying at the level of modules it's the same. In fact, in this particular example, you don't even have to go to the Q grade. It even works at the level of grade that they're the same. And the reason is that if you're looking at modules, so in the commutative case, I take the ideals, lambda x plus mu y. Take the ideal that generates. In the non-commutative case, I take the right ideal that generates and presumably look at the factor. Of course, that's perfectly well defined. Vector space-wise, it's the same thing as it would be in the commutative case, so there's no difference. And that really is, if you like, what's at the heart of these sort of theorems. Looking at modules, you're still okay. You do get this analogy. So our non-commutative curves are commutative. And there is actually a converse to this due to Idun Reitin and Michelle Vandenberg, which says that, so what should the converse be? Well, maybe we should go full bore and talk about non-commutative curves as what? As the categories, things that you would like to be Q-grade. So what would the theorem be is you should look at all the categories you can get in the non-commutative case. Think of the ones that look pretty much like coherent sheaves on a curve, projective in this case. Of course, it could be the commutative case, and there are a lot of other ones that turn up in non-commutative situation, where you take hereditary algebras, say upper triangular matrices, even something innocent like that, and look at all the modules on that. That has all the properties of coherent sheaves on a smooth irreducible curve. So what they did is they said, right, we'll just take these categories, the technical term is a growth and decay category, which have the properties that we want. And they have a list of about five of them. And then they wrote down the second list, they realized they could actually find a number of examples that looked like this. And although it's not the way they phrased the theorem, the consequence is that, in fact, these categories are Q-grade R, where R is pretty much what we had before. Connected graded ring, pieces grow linearly. It won't actually be a domain. That's the only problem. But it'll be some ring where the pieces grow linearly. So there is this converse going back and forth. So as consequences, first one I actually did out of order, slightly. So think again about
what happens when I take P1. Well, automorphism P1, they're the same as automorphisms of rational functions in U. At least if you do a change of variables, there's only two. U goes to QU, and U goes to U plus 1. And then you can ask, what about these quantum P1s, these quantum affine planes, or quantum affine P1s? Well, again, if you look in the literature, you only find two. You find the Q plane, xy equals qyx, and you find what's called the Jordan plane, xy equals yx plus y squared. Well, the theorem says that it's only those two, because these are the only automorphisms. And the L doesn't matter. I mean, the best you can do with P1 is replace O1 by O2. That just says, instead of taking polynomials in x and y, you just take the even degree pieces. Two other consequences. You can worry about the order of U. So there's a dichotomy. U could have finite order, infinite order. If it has finite order, the ring is actually a finite module over itself. You can sort of see that's reasonable, because if I take things of, if the order is n, and I take the elements of order n, and I unravel my multiplication, you'll find they commute. It's not far. There's a big subring which is commutative. That's not far from being a finite module over its center. But this takes some work. And the other dichotomy is when sigma is big, infinite order. And now we get the curious theorem that actually there are very few non-commutative rings, which is counterintuitive, because after all, there are more ways to get non-commutative relations than commutative. I don't have to assist x, y, y, x. But if sigma is in infinite order, there are only two types of curve where that's possible. It could be rational or elliptic. Rational case I've just talked about, of course I can put in some singularities. And the other possibility is elliptic. So there's only those two possibilities, very few of them. And also, by looking at what happens to the automorphisms, you can actually work out a lot of detail and structure about these. For example, when sigma has infinite order, the most you can have is two prime ideals. So that was this case, xy equals qyx. With this case, you work out there's only one, which is generated by y. And the elliptic case, in fact, there is one. So, further remarks. The correct way of talking about the sort of algebras we're talking about, if you need a dimension function, Krull dimension in the Q case would be obvious. The one that works naturally here is called GK dimension. And the nicest way of thinking about that is you take all the pieces up to degree n, so this doesn't need graded. Take the dimension of that and find the polynomial of smallest degree that bounds it. Take the degree. So polynomial ring in two variables, of course, this will give you two. So the theorem we just talked about actually works when the ring is GK2. And we can look at the possibilities. You can have GK0, that's finite dimensional, we can ignore. GK1, well, that should be a point. There's not much you can do to a point. You can't make a point non-commutative. You better get a polynomial ring in one variable, and you do. Again, up to finite fudges. And then you have two gap theorems. There's a famous old Bergman gap theorem which says there's no rings with GK between 1 and 2. So the first case really was curves. And then there's a very recent one due to Agata Smoktunovich, quite remarkable result, that says that if we're talking about connected graded domains, there are none with GK between 2 and 3. One reason why this is remarkable is there are very old theorems. GK dimension doesn't work like Hilbert series in the commutative case. Once you get up to 2, take any real number bigger than 2, that I can find you an algebra, or at least other people can find you an algebra, which have GK that number. So things are completely haywire. But remarkably, for domains, it doesn't, or connected graded domains, that doesn't happen. So conjecture for somebody to work out while later, or the rest of this talk, do the same theorem between 3 and 4. I would be extremely happy. So.
Do you know it's not always just true? Not always just an integer?
I don't know. I think it's, I mean, the counterexamples are very far from being domains. And what you basically do is, you know, you add in lots and lots of relations, so it grows a certain rate. You didn't make them graded. And then you add lots of relations in some degree, and then you let it grow exponentially again, and then you add lots more relations. And you just keep doing that, and so that the limit of these things becomes your favorite real number.
But you can't do that with domains, because you're tending to make x, y equals 0 all the way through. So for domains, yeah, Mike and I conjectured that it was true between 2 and 3. We didn't dare conjecture between 3 and 4 that it would be an integer. I've got no intuition, so I would love it to be true, and certainly there are no counterintuitives. There's nothing even close to a counterintuitive. I'll make it a conjecture. Connected graded domain, I can always deny it later. Connected graded domains have integer GK dimension. Let's be brave. So anyway, the next case up, given that, would be GK3, so that should be non-commutative surfaces. And now actually we go back to the beginning of the subject. So the subject actually started at this point, not where I started the talk. So the simplest thing would be P2. So let's try and see if we can construct non-commutative P2s. Well, certainly we can construct many, because I gave you xy equals qyx. Well, just do the same thing with three variables and make them q-commutative that way. That's a non-commutative P2. So what a non-commutative P2 should be, it should be something like the commutative case. The commutative case, P2 is prod of a polynomial ring in three variables. So let's try getting non-commutative analogs of a polynomial ring in three variables. And hopefully there'll be some interesting ones, which are not just x, y, and z, q commutative. And so this was work of Arden and Shelter. In fact, I think most of this is done, so Bill was here, sadly, before he died, and Arden was down here in the mid-80s, and this is work they did, I think, mostly down here. And so they set that up, and they put on some conditions, which I'll come in a minute. We're going to try to find all these rings. And there was one basic ring they just could not touch, and that is a ring that, I suppose, as seems to be true in all of mathematics, interesting rings always seem to come from physics. And this one, actually, after the event, was an analog of an algebra in four dimensions, the Sklianenfeld, that Adesky and Fagan then called the Sklianen algebra. And Mike and Bill found it independently, which was this algebra. And it's a very simple, naive-looking algebra. You take three scalars, A, B, and C. The known business there, don't make any of them zero, because that's too easy. And then you've got to avoid some roots of unity. There are 9 extra cases you have to avoid. So then just take the nicest, simplest sort of analog of xy minus yx equals 0. I'm going to take xy, a times xy plus b times yx, plus c times z squared equals 0. And then I cyclically commute that, so I get three relations. And they basically couldn't do anything with this algebra. I mean, it looks like a polynomial ring in three variables. So does it have the same Hilbert series? The number of elements of degree n, is it the same as a polynomial ring in three variables? Is it Noetherian? Is it a domain? Is it a prime ring? I mean, the weaker condition is prime ring, is that at least the product of non-zero ideals is non-zero. I don't think they could solve any of these. Generically, you can, but... And so this is where John came into the game, is they realized that you could understand these geometrically. And the geometric idea was that, in fact, you could find a factor ring, which was like one of the rings we've just been talking about. These twisted homogeneous coordinate rings of one I did before was P1. So you get a xy equals qyx. And after the event, you realize why you couldn't do anything about this. Because to understand that ring as they were doing, basically you're doing computations in some sense. Computations are linear. But this actually is controlled by an elliptic curve. And elliptic curves, you need some theory. You can't do elliptic curves just with bare hands. So I think that really is why they couldn't get anywhere. And so you have to get some sophistication. And sophistication comes from basically getting some geometry into the game. Even though the geometry is still only curves, we're still only worrying about an elliptic curve in this case. And the end story is that, yeah, you get this elliptic curve. We get this B of E L sigma. We know everything about that because that comes from the Arden-Vandenberg theorem, and that then controls everything about this. But you ask yourself in this case, okay, so he keeps getting these B's turning up. Why? In other words, slightly to change the question, I mean, the answer, obviously, is, well, you keep getting geometry turning up. So I keep getting curves, I keep getting varieties turning up out of this non-commutative structure. So I ask myself, how do I do that? And geometers have known the answer to such a question for for many years. And the answer is that you have something that's parameterized by, in this case, a curve. And again, if we think about what is it that should be parameterized, well, we should be looking at the points of whatever is the variety that we're talking about. Non-commutative analog of a point is a point module. So what's a point? Commutative case, a point, if we're looking at X being proj R, a point is just you look at a factor by a maximal non-irrelevant ID. So that factor will just look like Kx. So non-commutative case, well, I just take the same definition. What's interesting about Kx? It's cyclic. Its Hilbert series we know, it's dimension one in each piece. So I just take modules with that same property. So I talk about a point module. It should be generated, cyclic module, it should be therefore generated in degree zero, where each piece is one dimensional. So those have a chance of being the points of my variety. And actually, that's what happens. So let's think about doing that for the Scalian algebra. So with these three relations here. So you see, if I take a point module, I can reduce everything to equations. So I take my module. Each piece is one dimensional, so I just pick a basis element, mi. And then if I multiply an mi by one of my generators, xj, I'm just going to get a scalar times the next m. So that's my lambda ij. But then I say to myself, well, I take one of these relations, and if I multiply m0 by a relation, well, it better give me 0. So if I multiply that out, I take one of these relations, x squared plus by squared plus cz squared, then multiplying by m0, I replace x, y, z by the appropriate lambdas, and I get 0. But of course, that's a multiple of the basis vector, so that means these scalars are 0. So there you are. Out of the Scalian algebra, I'm getting a whole set of equations, in fact, three equations here, in six variables, because I've got first position, second. And actually, where you should think of that, therefore, first of all, it should be in projective, because everything's graded, so you always talk about projective, and it should be a P2 cross P2, because you distinguish between the first entry and the second entry. So if you like the non-commutative analog, where first and second entry matters, comes in the commutative case by looking at the product of two copies of P2. And we worry about whether we're in the first or the second situation. So you see very easily, the modules, the only way I can get a module is I must have these relations. And conversely, if I just worry about the first three steps, so in that case I take a truncated module, so that means I've just got M0, M1, and M2, and I factor out everything else. Then these truncated point modules are precisely defined by these equations. Because the only equations I have to worry about is multiply M0 by a relation to get 0. Nothing else matters. So that means, and in fact, then really it is genuinely what's called a parameterization in the commutative case. These things really are defined by this variety. So at the moment, that's true in general. There's absolutely complete generality there. Take any non-commutative ring, at least when it's got quadratic relations, then I can look at the truncated point modules of length 3 in this sense, and they are defined by the relation. Whether it does you any good, of course, is the other matter. So Amte and Werneberg, what they then did is they said, right, well, I've got just three equations here, two copies of P2. I can compute fairly easily what is the lambda that I'm getting. And what you find is that actually it's a graph of an automorphism of an elliptic curve. So it's just a set of points, x, comma, sigma of x, where the x is all lie in an elliptic curve, and the sigma then actually is an automorphism. So that's really just a computation. It's not a difficult one to do, but a bit more than I wanted to do here. Second point, you say, well, what is sigma? Well, there's always one sigma floating around here. Going from first position to second, you're increasing degree down my module, you know, from M0 to M1. And what's always happening there is that sigma is the shift. You shift the degree, the grading. So instead of starting at M0, you start at M1, but call that the zero position. So the sigma is always the shift on point one. And you can sort of imagine, once that I've got sigma as an automorphism and it is just the shift, given my module of length 3, I can sort of build up modules of arbitrary length by taking the first three and then mixing the next group of three, the next group of three. I can build up and get all the point modules. So in fact, once you have parts 1 and 3, you automatically get two. He actually parameterizes all the point modules. And then, in fact, I'm not sure if it's the other way around, that the definition of this twisted homogeneous coordinate ring was such that in this situation, you actually automatically got a ring homomorphism. The way that you've built up B out of the data of sigma and such like, or out of the data of the point modules, you automatically have a map from S to B. And then the theorem that goes with it, it's two parts. First of all, this map pi is surjective. That's rather easy. That's just computing that B here is actually generated by elements of degree 1. More subtle is that B actually is a factoring of S where you factor out a single central element. So that's a rather more subtle computation. And then once you've got those two facts, you can bootstrap everything you want to know about. You know everything about B. Going from A to B, you just factored out a central element. So you can bootstrap everything back to know everything about the original ring S. And the three key conditions that you have is it's global dimension 3, polynomially bounded growth. In fact, in this case, it's the same Hilbert series as the polynomial ring in three variables. And then there's a technical Gorenstein condition, which is if you take the X groups from K, that's R, you take the ring R, S. So you take S and you factor out everything in positive degree, identify that with K. Then those X groups should be either 0 or K in one particular case. So just a technical condition. So these are made called Arden-Shelter regular rings. And the converse to this theorem is, well, not only can we do it for one ring, but we can do it for all of them. So if you take one of these AS regular rings, and these are the rings that Arden and Shelter are actually looking at, then all of them can be classified in the same way. So there are two distinct possibilities, special cases. It could be just one of these twisted homogeneous coordinates. It can, in fact, be the same sort of thing with P1 cross P1. Actually, what case that was happening there is I take a polynomial ring in three variables, but I give them different weights, 1, 1, 2. Or it's like the Skliadenauschen. You have this factor, which is B of EL sigma, where E is a curve. And in this third case, R is actually uniquely determined by this data. So there are only two cases. You've got the P2 type case or the P1 cross P1, and you can distinguish those by Hilbert series. So let's suppose that R grows just like a polynomial ring in three variables. So it has the Hilbert series of a polynomial ring in three variables, 1 over 1 minus T cubed. So in that case, I'll call it a non-commutative P2. Why not? So in particular, that holds for the Skliadenauschen algebra. So in the Skliadenauschen algebra, you should think of this as a non-commutative P2. But it's somehow inside this non-commutative P2. And you think of how we draw P2, there's P2. So there's my non-commutative P2, since it's all wiggly. But inside there's this honest elliptic curve. All I mean by that is that this whole wiggly space is all modules over R. But inside there, I've got all modules over B. And the modules over B, remember, that's the same as sheaves, coherent sheaves on E. So that's the same. So the way you should think about S is it's this sort of amorphous non-commutative P2, but it's got this very rigid elliptic curve sitting inside it. So I said that we'll think of these as non-commutative P2. Why not? The justification for that is work of Bondel and Polishchuk, and it's a rather fun theorem. So this is a long paper, but I'll give you the idea. So I want to prove that theorem. What do I mean by non-commutative P2? About as much as you do, assuming you haven't seen these. But at least it should contain P2. And then you should say, well, a deformation of P2 is still surely a non-commutative P2, so I'll contain all deformations of P2. What do you know about deformations? Not probably as much as I do. I know almost nothing about them. What I do know about them is deformation theory. Certain things are rigid when you deform. With P2, O1, O2, O3, those things are rigid. So these are the exceptional objects. So whatever it is, it's got to have these analogs of 01, 02, 03. Okay. That's my definition of a non-commutative P2. It's a category with whatever properties you have for the 01, 02, 03 written out. But actually, not much more of that. And the Rockel theorem they had, rather like the actually later theorem of Idun Wright and Michel Vandenberg, is that they were able to classify these, and it turned out that what you got were just the Q-grade R, where R was a AS regular ring dimension 3. So in that sense, these really are the only non-commutative features. Just to be a little scurrilous, I will say that you could argue that my talk tomorrow in the algebra seminar was saying that's a false statement. I'll skip that slide. So there is a program, by the way, for the next step of this, which is, well, classified curved surfaces. And there's an program of Artin and Vandenberg, which goes rather like the punitive case. You do it in three steps. First of all, you classify them birationally, which means you classify, in the punitive case, fields of fractions, in non-commutative case, division rings of fractions. And Artin conjectures, we know those. They're just ones we all know, the interesting one being the Sklyanin algebra division. Then you classify the so-called minimal models. In the rational case, this is P2, P1 cross P1, and so-called P1 bundles on P1. And those have probably been classified, again, by Bondel, Polishchuk, and then Vandenberg, rather in the same way as I said down there. If you believe that as a proof, they're classified. If you don't believe that as a proof, it's wide open. And then the third step should be that you get any non-commutative surface by you can blow it up and down successfully, and you'll end up with a minimal model, and that'll do the classification. So in the non-commutative case, there is a notion due to Vandenberg again of blowing up and down, but nobody has any idea whether you can prove that sort of theorem. But rather than do that, let me, in the last few minutes, just a hint at another application. So, one of the things you can do, obviously in the commutative case, projective geometry in some ways is nicer than affine geometry, and one of the ways you go from the one to the other is you complete. So we can play the game in the non-commutative case. And one of the nicest examples of that is, take perhaps the most ubiquitous ring in the non-commutative case, the first file algebra. So this is just all differential operators with polynomial coefficients in one variable. So This is a beautiful theory, starting with works of Cannons and Holling, and then Barrist and Wilson, which says you want to classify all the right ideals of this ring. That's a rather dry project, except that the answer turned out to be the same as some other really beautiful mathematics. So it turned out that these correspond in a one-to-one way with so-called Grassmann, the Vedic Grassmann of Wilson. That's just a direct product of these very concrete matrix spaces. You take n by n matrices, a pair of them, take the difference of two of them and subtract the identity, and make that as small as possible. It cannot be zero, by the way, without x and y commute. So you want that rank to be as small as possible, one. So this turns up in a lot of mathematics, about which David can tell you much more than I can, particularly in the integral systems, about which I know nothing. So there's an approach for dealing with this, which is you go from affine to projective. So by projective, I need to get a graded ring. Well, I can always make a ring graded by just adding another variable and multiplying all the relations by the appropriate power so everything's homogeneous. So I do that. I introduce Z, which will be central, and instead of X, Y being commuting to 1, which is what happens with X and D by DX, I make it equal to z squared. So this is a non-commutative plane. So it's one of these algebras we know a lot about. Although in this case, actually, the b that you get, I've written it down here as factoring out z, so I just get a polynomial ring in two variables. In fact, it's z cubed, so it's a sort of triple line at infinity. So then, translate the problem, right ideals here become so-called reflexive ideals, where I mod xi, zi is b. So at infinity, in terms of sheaves, you'd say they'd be trivial at infinity. And, or you can look at the same thing sitting inside Q grade. Now I'll just so I'm looking at torsion-free rank 1 modules. So those are just the images of right ideals. And there are a couple of invariants I can put on this. One is the first Chern class. That's irrelevant, because I just shift the grading, and I'll get a degree 0. so we can ignore that. And the second is a thing called the Euler characteristic. And the theorem, so this is really, I think, due to Beres and Wilson. So they got all, this is their one-to-one correspondence. Also, Baranovsky, Ginzburg, and Kuznetsov have versions of this. In the way I'm phrasing it here, where we get on moduli spaces, this is work of Tom Nevins and myself. And if you want more sophisticated versions of this, which work with much more general varieties, you should go again to the work of David and Tom, where they're working with much more general cases and with much more applications. So all I want to point out is that the slightly different incarnation of Calogero-Moser space is that the right ideals in the Weyl algebra actually correspond to one of the more beautiful varieties in the commutative case, the Hilbert scheme of n points. So this is, you take in P2 in this case, you take an ideal sheaf such that the factor is just n points, n dimensional, length n. And so that then corresponds to the n points. And inside, so that actually parameterizes everything, all torsion-free modules. And to get the modules that correspond to A1 itself, you ignore the stuff at infinity. So that's now corresponding to affine 2 space. And again, I take there the corresponding Hilbert scheme. In the commutative case, that's parametrizing ideals. But here it parametrizes projective modules. And the reason is that there are no, the fact, you see, in the commutative case, you're looking at the ring modern ideal, which has length n. Well, in the non-commutative case, that means I've got a point module. But the only point modules I have for this homogenized Weyl algebra is those at infinity. And I've deleted infinity here. So I've got no points. So how about miraculously these points become non-points, projective modules? And that's the correspondence. So I've rushed that last bit a little. But that's good, because that means you have to ask David, who will explain this to you in much greater detail, because he has much better, more general theorems about it. Thank you for your attention.
Questions?
How come in that theorem that you had up there, the one where you had P2 and P1 cross P1?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you get the blow up of P2 at a point? Or could you repeat the question?
So the question was, in the Armitage-Vandenberg theorem, looking at non-commutative P2s, you're worried about, you could take P2, P1 cross P1, and blow up P2 at just one point, or?
Or whatever, and then just do your construction with the, you need a sigma or something, right? Or
yeah, so, I mean, the question is, what sort of ring do I get out? I mean, the rings do you want to get out of that? Crucially, you needed this Gorenstein condition, and that wouldn't be true in that sort of case. Can't be, because they're not in the theorem. I mean, but I guess it's taking to get from P2 to P1 cross P1, blow up at what, 6 points? I forget what the general quadratic in that sense. So there are ways of going from one to the other, but you need the Gorenstein condition. That's actually a very strong condition. Because in the commutative case, the condition reduces you down just to P2, a polynomial ring of 3 variables, because they're just finite global dimensions is forcing you to have a polynomial. So it's only in the non-commutative case that you can get these other examples.